Public discussion of current problems is an American privilege. In the interest of freedom of thought and speech, Northwestern University presents The Reviewing Stand. Today's subject is our relations with China. Guest speakers on The Reviewing Stand panel are Lewis Wirth from the University of Chicago, Annie Klo Watson, National Secretary of the Citizens Committee to Repeal the Chinese Exclusion Act, Francis E. McMahon from the University of Notre Dame, and Paul Meadows from Northwestern University. James H. McBurney, Dean of the Northwestern School of Speech, is the moderator. Reprints of today's program are available for 10 cents or the current series of 26 issues for $1. If you wish reprints, please write to the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois, or station WGN Chicago. And now to listeners across the nation and to guests gathered here in Mutual's WGN studios in Chicago, Northwestern University presents The Reviewing Stand and the subject, Our Relations with China.
Last week, China completed her sixth year of war with Japan. For the last year and a half, we have been her ally in that struggle. Today on The Reviewing Stand, we propose to examine our relations with China in an effort to indicate desirable directions for future policy, bases for sound relations. One of the most persistent questions that we receive from our Reviewing Stand listeners is this. Why don't we give more military aid to China? Are we letting China down? Now, how do you people see this question? Worth?
Well, McBurney, I'm not one of the millions of armchair strategists that we have in the United States. All of us realize, if you just read our daily papers, that we're fighting a war on many fronts. We can't have all of our forces at each front. Therefore, we have to distribute them in accordance with the best judgment of those in charge. And I believe our commander-in-chief and our military men have decided that for the time being, we should not concentrate most of our forces in China.
I'm wondering how you see this, Meadows. What percentage of our lend-lease materials has gone to China?
It's estimated about 2% of our lend-lease materials have gone to China.
Whose estimate is that?
That's Mr. Stettinius, his director of lend-lease.
And does he have an opinion on this subject?
He has felt that we have not given the aid to China which we ought to have given. In any case, we are seeing China becoming rapidly one of the weak links in the chain of allies against the aggressors. I think it's very significant that the president himself has found it necessary to reassure the Chinese of our increasing support in the future.
Isn't it fair to say, though, that all of our military operations in the Pacific really constitute aid to China?
Oh, I think so, McBurney. And I think it should be kept in mind that we are committed to a policy of liquidating Nazi Germany first. And with that policy, it follows, I think, that we cannot give quite all the aid we would like to at the present time, nor all the aid that will be forthcoming.
I think everyone realizes, and I'm sure Meadows, even Mr. Stettinius must realize, that the collapse of China would be a catastrophe for us, and we shall not let it happen.
Well, I think this panel has at least indicated a rather clear attitude on the matter of further military aid to China. Perhaps, as you suggest, we're to pursue this question further would involve us in questions of military strategy upon which we do not have the facts. I think, though, that a pretty good place to begin this discussion is with the attitude toward the Chinese, which appears to be expressed in our immigration law. This is a question which we can discuss today. Since 1882, all Chinese have been excluded from this country by law. There are now before Congress several bills which would change this situation. I know that you're familiar with that legislation, Ms. Watson. Won't you tell us just a bit about it?
Well, activity on this question so far has been in the House. The Gossett bills call for the repeal of Chinese exclusion laws, placing of Chinese immigration on a quota basis, and repeal of laws denying Chinese the right of naturalization. The Kennedy and Magnuson bills, though less comprehensive in statement, have the same general aim.
Now, how do you people feel about this legislation? I think we ought to hear from each of you on this. What's your position, Warren?
Well, my feeling is, McBurney, that this Chinese exclusion is, of course, part of all of the Oriental exclusion. While the Exclusion Act, that is, the act prohibiting Chinese to come here as residents and to acquire citizenship, went into effect in 1882, subsequent legislation has extended it, and we've had the legislation with reference to the so-called barred zone, which kept out Orientals of all sorts as residents of the United States, though we admitted visitors and merchants and so on. Now, to me, that has always been an obnoxious thing because we've discriminated against races and specific nations. I have no objection to any nation setting up whatever standards it wants for immigration to its country, but the standards must be applied equally to all nations and not be applied as a weapon against one nation.
Do you agree with that analysis, McMahon?
I do, and perhaps a philosopher could quote a fellow philosopher, that master of practical wisdom, Confucius. He was once asked what a gentleman was, and he answered, "A gentleman is one who puts words into deeds first and sorts what he says to the deed." Now, we Americans have been profuse in our words about liberty, equality, and justice. But the Chinese exclusion laws show that sometimes our deeds do not measure up to our words.
You line up with a philosopher there, Meadows?
I most certainly do. I think that barring people from residence and citizenship in our country on the basis of race or color is just as dishonorable as Pearl Harbor and just as indefensible as Hitler's Nuremberg Law.
Well, that's a pretty strong statement.
Well, I'd like to make a comment on that because I don't like to see us put on the same level with Hitler. Of course, that's one reason why I want these laws changed. But I don't think we are quite on the same level with Hitler. After all, it seems to me that these laws are a carryover of the 19th century attitude toward the Oriental peoples and the so-called backward peoples of the world. And we have been trying to make progress. We're not proud of them anymore. And China's position as our ally makes us peculiarly sensitive of our guilt.
Now, how do you see this, Miss Watson?
I think we have to come down to the present time and be very practical and realize that in the winning of the war, we must remove every possible barrier to close cooperation of Chinese and American troops. If we are to believe the story of interracial cooperation at Bataan, and the testimony of men like Admiral Yarnell. Also, I think remedial legislation is necessary, if for no other reason than to dignify the place of the American-born Chinese in this, his native land.
Now, before discussing these immigration proposals specifically, may I ask to what extent the attitude indicated in our immigration laws epitomizes that of our general policy toward China? That question is suggested by what you said just a minute ago, Worth. Take our economic policy toward China, for example. Do you think that this has been as shabby as you appear to think our immigration policy has been?
I don't think it has been as shabby, McBurney. As a matter of fact, I think our economic relations with China have, on the whole, been cooperative and mutually respectful. What is more, I think they have been at least on as high a level of decency as those of any other nation dealing with China.
I think, however, that the Chinese feel that it's been just that our relationship economically, like the relationships with other powers to China, have been just as shabby as our immigration policies. In other words, the whole system of unequal treaties, of most favored nation, of the fair words and foul deeds which have accompanied our open door policy, are the basis for the Chinese resentment.
Wait a minute, Meadows. It seems to me you single us out as particularly bad treaters of China. Have we been any worse than any other nation that we know of?
I don't think we've been any worse, but my feeling is that from the reading of American diplomatic history that at times we have been the cat's paw for certain other powers which have utilized our leadership in the Orient due to a number of factors to cover up certain things. I have in mind, for example, that the open-door policy of John Hay was really developed by the British Lord Beresford, who was in this country at the time, and who saw the advantages of American position in this matter.
In view of China's undeveloped economy, though, and political impotence in past years, I'm wondering if we could wisely have pursued any other policy there in Japan. What do you think?
Well, there were difficulties, of course. So far as I know, the original attitude of the Chinese nation was, and it's to be understood, a kind of hostility towards foreign infiltration of any kind. That has been changed, and certainly changed radically. And may I just say here, too, that however you two may quarrel about the motives and effects of our economic activities, there has always been that disinterested level of missionary activity in China on the part of both Protestants and Catholics, which has resulted in and a significant help in the cultural life of China.
Yes, and it has meant not merely the exporting of missionaries, it's meant the exportation of health measures, the exportation of American education, and the export of American technology, which also has opened up, in turn, the path of trade. But I would like to protest against the idea that we have just been the worst of the imperialists. We have lived in an imperialist world, and it seems to me we can't expect higher standards than those that prevail in the world from any other nations unless some one nation is willing to do it with force, and we weren't prepared to use force.
I'm merely impressed with the realism of the Chinese who have identified Western civilization in the current phrase, which is very well known in China, Western civilization as being synonymous with Bibles, bullets, and beer.
But they thought the Bibles, bullets, and beer not exclusively from the Americans, had they?
Well, now I wonder if we hadn't better return this discussion to our present relations with China. We started off with these proposals to abolish the Chinese Exclusion Act and put the Chinese immigrant on the same basis as others. I wonder if we're not in some danger of endorsing this proposition prematurely. Tell us this, Worth. What were the reasons for excluding the Chinese in the first place?
I think there were a number of reasons, McBurney. The first reason was that the exclusion of the Chinese coincides, as far as time is concerned, with the settlement of our frontier. As long as this was an open country with great many resources to be exploited, we allowed immigration to come here freely because we needed labor. When we reached the coast, we changed our mind. And so the Chinese were a low-standard labor group. They worked for low wages and competed with American labor, so it was thought, and American laborers didn't like to see them come in and broke down what little standards they had of wages and hours. I recall reading a famous speech made by the leader of one part of the American labor movement. It was entitled Meat versus Rice. The idea was that if you allowed great numbers of the Orientals to come in, the American workers would be reduced from a meat diet to a rice diet. Now, I don't think he was right, because I don't think the Chinese have competed with American labor. They've gone into specific trades and occupations which American labor on the whole has avoided.
Would you say there was a racial element concerned there as regards the difficulties the Chinese had, as well as the economic?
Definitely, McMahon. Of course, they were an alien people. They were visibly different from the others, and that always makes a welcome difficulty. And what is more, we already had our race problem with relation to the Negro. And we generalized from our attitude to the Negro to our attitude toward the Oriental. Although it's important to note that the Oriental feeling arose primarily in California and spread from there.
I think in that connection that the repeal of the Chinese Exclusion Act would mean would symbolize to the Pacific areas that we were repudiating the biracialism that has characterized our immigration and other policies.
Also, for those people who would object to large numbers of Chinese coming into the country, they would be comforted to know that only 107 Chinese would come under the quota if the quota were reckoned on the same basis as that of all other nations.
Now, what is this quota to which you refer here?
The quota law of 1924, which would give the Chinese a quota of 107.
But you can imagine, Miss Watson, what kind of propaganda use the Japanese could make of that. If out of the 400-odd million people in China, we only allow 107 a year to enter the United States, they might say, well, you see, it's easy for them to get rid of their discrimination because it doesn't make really any difference. There will be only a little or so 107 people.
I agree with you, Dr. Worth, but unless we change the basic immigration law, that will be the quota.
Oh, I agree with you. We should abolish it, Miss Watson, but I think it would be primarily a symbolic significance rather than an actual significance.
Well, I think Chinese officials well understand that their interest is to have China recognized on the basis of equality and reciprocity. They are not concerned precisely with the question of immigration. In fact, Chiang Kai-shek feels that the post-war China will demand its millions for the reconstruction of that devastated country.
It might have a very nice symbolic value for our own people. It might indicate to our own people that we were rejecting the racialism of certain sections of our country.
Well, now, in proposing, though, to place the Chinese immigrant on the same basis as others, don't we run into an assimilation problem with the Chinese, which we do not have to face with most European immigrants?
Well, before I answer that, McBurney, may I just say here that the Chinese are not the only Far Eastern people excluded by our laws, though it happens that they are the only people discriminated against by name in the laws of the United States. Now, it seems to me that if we are going to decide this matter of immigration on the basis of principle, we would be much wiser if we enacted laws that would abolish the restrictions and the barring of the peoples in the Far East, save those who are now engaged in war against the United Nations.
May I comment on that point? I think there is no doubt that one reason why we're in the war with Japan today dates back to an Oriental exclusion bitterly resented by the Japanese people.
I'm not so sure that that's true, Meadows. I would be willing to admit it may be a factor. It may be one of the little embers that has contributed to the conflagration. But I don't think it's been by any means the most important factor. I think Japan has been a rising imperialist power and is out for conquest, and this little irritation might have just fanned the flames of discontent.
I think there's one more thing that should be said for the possibility of the assimilation of the Chinese. We should turn to the record that has been made by the American Chinese on the Pacific Coast. They have been good students. They have had a low rate of delinquency. They have adopted American standards of living and of employment just as rapidly as we would permit them to.
Apparently, then, the record of the Chinese is amazing, considering the fact that the picturesque Chinatowns of America are some of the worst slum areas of the country.
How many Chinese do we have in this country now, Ms. Watson?
We have about 78,000.
And how does that compare with other minority racial groups?
All around 125,000 Japanese, 45,000 Filipinos, 2,500 Indians, and 1,500 Koreans.
Indians, you mean Hindus?
Yes, in round numbers, of course.
Ms. Watson, you'd perhaps agree with me that there is just a trace, at least, of Anglo-Saxon racialism in our blood, which makes the problem of assimilation of Chinese people a little more difficult than in the case of those, say, coming from Europe. An Anglo-Saxon racialism, which is certainly in conflict with the very principles of our country, I do not believe our Declaration of Independence says all Anglo-Saxons are created equal. It says all men are created equal.
Yes, but it's easier said than done, McMahon, to make our principles a reality. The point is we recognize these principles and we are working to achieve them. We haven't achieved them yet, and that ought to be, the recognition of that ought to be our greatest spur to activity.
Well, now, you people seem to be substantially agreed that the abolition of the Chinese Exclusion Act at this time would have great symbolic significance. I'm wondering about this. Who are the people opposed to this action worth, and how can they be dealt with?
Well, some of the opposition, McBurney, comes locally from the Pacific Coast, where most of the Chinese are to be found. These people object to the Chinese largely on traditional grounds. It seems to me I see no reason why the Chinese should at present be a thorn in their side. As a matter of fact, they're very much in demand in the cutting off of Chinese immigration created a dearth of these immigrants here who were designed for certain jobs by the Californians and other Pacific Coast people. But there is that local tradition of opposition. The second opposition, it seems to me, stems from what McMahon has already referred to, namely the general racial antagonism that perhaps is due to our attitude toward the Negroes and toward the Mexicans, toward other aliens, and that was true for a long time toward the immigrants. And the third is the economic factor, namely the alleged competition of these immigrants with American labor and their tendency to pull down American labor standards. I don't think that third argument is very sound anymore, because we have minimum wage laws and maximum hour laws, we have better labor organization, and it seems to me that there wouldn't be enough competition between Chinese and American laborers anyway to make any difference.
Well, now, if we may accept Worth's statement as a summary of our position on this matter of immigration, I suggest that we move on to another aspect of our relations with China. Great Britain and the United States recently relinquished all extraterritorial rights in China. What significance, Meadows, do you attach to this action? Do you think that this is indicative of a changing political attitude toward China?
I think that the relinquishment of extraterritoriality has been on the way for quite a long time. We've been unsure of what the results of such a relinquishment would be in China, but at least we are committed to it by formal agreement with China at the present time. We would have done it 20 years ago if we had not felt the necessity at the close of the last war of appeasing Japan in the situation in the Far East.
These extraterritorial rights were quite evidently, I think, a breach against the sovereignty of the Chinese nation. It is a matter of justice that we do abolish them. I think it does augur better relations on the basis of equality with Far Eastern
people. Perhaps someone ought to explain here just briefly what we mean by these extraterritorial rights.
Well, these rights gave special privileges to foreigners and the representatives of foreign nations, particularly in the harbor cities. It allowed them to have their own police, their own armed forces, their garrisons, and their own courts. In other words, we did not subject ourselves to Chinese sovereignty when we were trading and doing business and visiting in these areas.
I don't think we should be kidding ourselves, however. I have a feeling that after the war, China will put an end to extraterritoriality regardless of what we may be feeling about the situation at the present time.
Well, I agree with you on that, but I think the question is whether the idea of extraterritoriality will be done away with throughout the world. I think there is every prospect that insofar as there are sovereign nations to be dealt with, extraterritoriality would be a thing of the past, because it's a slap in any nation's face.
On that point, however, I think the Orientals are very much confused by the fact that we have not been willing to develop for the Pacific a charter that is comparable to the one which we have developed for the Atlantic.
Of course, no one has ever said, at least President Roosevelt hasn't said, that this charter could not apply to the whole world.
That is true. The President has not said that. But Mr. Churchill has in his statement that he does not intend to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire.
Yeah, but I think you're bringing in a point here which would lead us far afield from the discussion that we have on this reviewing stand.
Well, certainly we are agreed here that the relinquishment voluntarily on the part of this country and Great Britain, of all of these extraterritorial rights in China, is a step in the right direction, aren't we? It would seem to me, then, that apart from the military questions of the moment, perhaps the most important factor governing our relations with China must be our conception of the China of the future. And it seems to me that we have come to that in this discussion. Now, let me put the question this way. Do you think that China is capable of assuming leadership in the Far East? Is China potentially a great industrial nation? What kind of economic development do you anticipate for China? How do you react to those questions?
Well, I shall simply comment from the only point of view a philosopher could, perhaps, and that is the nation that leads must be a nation of deep historic culture, of vision. And I think too many Americans forget that China's culture is centuries old. It has been very, very rich. And that China, throughout the centuries in the Far East, has been far more the teacher of the neighboring nations than it has been the learner.
But on the other hand, McMahon, wouldn't you agree that China's culture, as far as the modern world is concerned, has been somewhat dormant and archaic? That is, she has not awakened with the spurt, for instance, that Japan awakened with. And what we have seen since the revolution led by Sun Yat-sen in China is a new spirit. And that new spirit has the richness of background that you speak of, but it also has the problem of adapting itself to the modern scientific and technological world.
Adapting itself to the best that we can offer, both in technically and culturally, but at every instance, our obligation to respect that deep historic culture of China.
Well, now, granting your point, McMahon, which I think is important, do you people think that China is potentially a great industrial nation?
Well, one way to answer that, McBurney, is to look at her resources. China is rich in resources of an agricultural sort. She can be a great agricultural nation. China also has some industrial resources. She has a great deal of coal. She has very little oil and very little iron. She has a great many minerals like tungsten and mercury and antimony and tin. These could be developed, and they will be developed in the post-war period. But she does not have the base for a great industrial nation.
Miss Watson?
However, Dr. Wirth, don't you think that industrialization can come in the agricultural field as well as in the field of the machine of industry?
That's where I think her greatest future lies.
How do you see this, Meadows?
I think that we shouldn't forget that one of the things which the war with Japan is bringing to China is a national development, the development of a nation state that is strong and looks forward to the future. This is something that China has not had. And I think it's significant that the Chinese people themselves look forward to a great industrialization. The fact, for example, that the Chinese government is in the Yunnan province at the present time, an area which is not densely populated, which is far from the commercial cities of the coastline, is a very significant factor for the unification and industrial development of China.
I agree with you, Meadows, in national development, but it is significant and interesting to see that it's going to be apparently a national development that understands that China cannot embrace the exaggerated nationalism that has characterized our nations in the past 20 years. That Chiang Kai-shek, for example, recognizes the need he has so advocated of a post-war world organization and an international police force to be used how and to be promoted for what end? As the general has said, to emancipate mankind and to bring about the realm of democracy throughout the world.
Since there seems to be some question about our ability to get lend-lease materials to China during the war, we might remember that we have a great market for our great war machines and our great industries after the war, which we'll not be able to use for ourselves in China.
Do you gentlemen and Miss Watson anticipate that Russia and some of the other European powers will present barriers to this development that you're talking about?
Well, I think in the case of Russia, China will have to make her peace with Russia, and Russia will have to make her peace with China. I can see China getting back Formosa from Japan. I can see Korea being an independent nation. I can see Manchuria coming back to China or being an independent state closely allied with China. Outer Mongolia will probably again be an independent state or will somehow or other be peacefully settled in its relations with Russia and China. But most important of all, I can see China as the leader in the Far East, a nation that will either be for us and with us in maintaining peace all over the world, or at least over a large area, or a nation that will be against us and strangled by other nations.
In any case, what the Chinese are looking forward to is a democratic co-prosperity sphere in the greater East Asia rather than a Japanese sphere.
I hope you're right, Meadows, but I don't see as yet that China is a democracy. She's well on the way to becoming one.
And how China goes certainly will depend a great deal upon what America decides and the American people.
Well now, Miss Watson and gentlemen, may I suggest this in very brief summary. It seems clear that we may expect a new and more progressive China in the years to come. And it seems equally clear that we cannot begin too soon to recognize this in our military, political, and economic relations with China. This panel seems to be agreed that one thing of considerable symbolic significance, at least, which we can do now, is to give American Chinese and Chinese seeking entrance into the United States equal rights with the nationals of other countries. For some time to come, however, we shall have to look forward to extending substantial aid and counsel to China.
Thank you, gentlemen. You've been listening to the Northwestern University Reviewing Stand discussion of Our Relations with China with Lewis Wirth, University of Chicago, Annie Claw Watson, Committee to Repeal the Chinese Exclusion Act, Francis McMahon, University of Notre Dame, and Paul Meadows, Northwestern University. Moderator James H. McBurney is the Dean of the School of Speech at Northwestern University.